Welcome to RPG Ramblings with Jeff Jones. This is a weekly show exploring the various details of the tabletop RPG hobby through discussions with interesting people. Today, Jeff Grubb joins me. He is known for the prolific number of game supplements he wrote for TSR back in the day. His involvement in so many iconic projects makes him one of the key people who shaped the directions of Dungeons & Dragons in the 80s and 90s. He left TSR decades ago, but his proverbial pen still keeps writing. As to be expected, we ramble about things old and new. Have a Patreon that pays for my Zoom subscription. If you have some extra shekels burning a hole in your pocket, feel free to follow the link and support the show. The portal is opening, sisters and brothers. It is time to get rambling. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, Jeff.
Am I hearing an echo?
Maybe. Yeah.
Well, I've got the famous or infamous, I'm not sure which, Jeff Grubb right here. Well, thanks for joining me, Jeff.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it was funny. I just happenstantially, I guess a little more planned than happenstantially, but I was at GaryCon walking around and bumped into you. And I thought, whoa, Jeff Grubb. I want to see if he wants to come on my podcast.
GaryCon was, in my opinion, one of the best run conventions I've been at in years. I've been at a lot of well-run, well-organized conventions, but everything moves so smoothly at GaryCon. Plus, it was old home week. I had spent many years in Lake Geneva. For those who don't know, maybe a few of you. GaryCon is an annual convention. Guy Gackthorne's Gary's son, and a wonderful team, and it's hosted in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, which was the home of TSR, the original publishers of Dungeons & Dragons. And it's held at I don't even remember the current name of it, but at one time, long ago and far away, it was the Playboy Resort. And it has since, I think it's called like the Grand Geneva now, which is this, very sprawling hotel resort located on several golf courses east of town, the other side of the highway.
It puts the sprawl into sprawling. I never seen sprawling like this kind of sprawl,
it was designed, and they have a little plaque up for this, by some students of Frank Lloyd Wright. So it was done in his prairie style, which is to say, low buildings that tend to hug the geography. So therefore it was like, you'd walk down a hallway to the end of a complex, and then you have to go up half a set of stairs, then you walk down to the next set of stairs, then you walk down to the, and finally you get to the lobby. It's definitely a spread out operation.
Well, it's also each building's like two stories, but yes, they alternate. Like one being like the basement and the first level, the next one being the first level and the second level.
Second level, yeah. So there's no straight shot, it's kind of cool. But anyway, a lot of old friends still live in Southeast Wisconsin. So, we had an opportunity of it being old home week. It was going back for a reunion, the high school reunion. See how we've changed, how we haven't changed. Most of my cohort are now talking about retirement, that sort of, and grandkids. And, that's been, it was really, really nice to, get together with a lot of people I haven't seen in years. It's been like 25 years since I left Lake Geneva. And also finding out, everything that's changed now, too. So, and hasn't changed.
Yeah, it's my first time having been there. I didn't know quite what to expect, but I was pleasantly surprised with, the only weirdness it was first arriving to the convention, I was very confused. Like I was looking for a building, something like that would stand out, there was no such thing.
Well, you pass past the, water park hotel first before you get to the Grand Geneva Hotel. If you go too far, you end up at the ski lodge,
I end up having to park in the I call it the airport, but it's actually just a landing strip.
Right. They had a small landing strip there. I don't know if it's still in service or not, but that was, again, back when it was Playboy Resort. And, of course, on Saturday, we got 6 inches of snow.
Yes.
So if you rent a car in Wisconsin in March, you really should make sure there's a snow scraper in it.
Yeah, in fact, I think I took my vehicle, and I'm from Illinois. I took my, and for some reason, I didn't have a brush or a scraper, but I learned to make do because obviously
it wasn't bad. It wasn't really bad, and you know, basically, it melted enough that we could get, you know, everybody out on Sunday.
Well, but I think it gives everybody the Lake Geneva experience, right?
Yes. No. I always say that. That's one reason TSR did so well, is that in the winter, we had very little else to do. I mean, it was a tourist town. People would come up for the summer. And, you know, during the winter, it would start snowing. And, hey, you know, you might as well write and play games. So.
Yeah, I think that's... That this appeared to be why I think a lot of the role-playing games didn't develop in large metropolitan areas. They were more in the smaller rural areas.
Well, there was like an arc between Minneapolis down toward Lake Geneva and then continuing into Chicago. And basically, there was a lot of people who, you know, played games early, you know, with the early gang, with the Castle and Crusade Society, and also a lot of small companies that set themselves up. Faza was based out of there, and out of Minneapolis. So basically, we had like an arc there. There was another pod around Austin, GURPS, Steve Jackson gang, and another pod in the Bay Area, Arthouse, Thorian, Chaosium, there in that group. That all, you know, basically, and people, you know, in the area around Seattle had a lot of cases where people would be working for Wizards of the Coast and then they would spur off and they would form their own company.
Right.
So we see a lot of small companies, and, you know, Paizo and Kobold basically came out of that, you know, era of game company. And it's kind of cool.
Yeah, I was, Bloomington's just like 40 miles from here, and that's
GDW territory, isn't it?
Yep. And then Decatur was south of that by about an hour, and there's a Judges Guild, so it's it's strange, but you know, now those companies have they're no longer that have the same glory. They've kind of passed sometimes on to different hands in different ways, to some for the good, and some for not
they're,
so good.
They're sometimes they're forgotten. Sometimes they've been resurrected by others, you know, who have, you know, picked up the name or the title or the backstock, and you know, there's a lot of, you know, old school revival type of operations as well. And this is kind of cool.
It is. And I guess I'm also surprised, you know, having thought that the heyday was in the 80s for role-playing games, and then seeing kind of seems like I thought the demise in the early aughts. Mm-hmm. It's really kind of surprising where we're at now, where we're in an age that exceeds the former glories.
I think it, you know, changes its nature every so often. Because, you know, we're not in the same type of space we were before. Now we have Critical Role and, you know, live play events on YouTube. We have all manner of, you know, podcasts and the like. And we have Kickstarter. And it used to be, I was getting into it, was desktop publishing was just getting its start. Before then, you might have a mimeograph machine.
All right.
I don't know if you've ever seen any of the old Alarums and Excursions magazines.
No, I haven't.
This was before there was an internet. This was a collection of zines where you would write four pages of your thoughts about game design or the campaign you're running or a story, and you send them into Lee Gold, who would then assemble them all in a huge book with those, you know, brass connectors on it, and distribute it to everybody else or later on Stable. And this was a communications device. It was almost like, you know, passing notes in class. And I whenever I got a copy of it, I always, you know, didn't understand half of it because it was continuing conversations from issues that we have never seen. And every collection was done in a different color paper. So, you know, there'd be a blue section, there'd be a red section. So everybody would have, you know, so you could tell how long people's sections were. And that's a great piece of, you know, role-playing history right there, as far as, you know, but it's sometimes not easy to understand what we're saying only because it's a conversation among friends and everybody's using their own terms, their own jargon and stuff that they came out of miniatures. They came out of, you know, early role playing and trying to fit it all together. It's an interesting challenge.
Yeah. I mean, it really is. I mean, later on, I mean, obviously the internet offered things like the forums and things, but right before then it was
right.
Especially, you know, in people that are young don't realize like there was even like play by post for various word games and things like
yes.
that.
Yes. Yes, the kids get off our lawn. The play-by-mail type things. I think I did StarWeb for about 3 months. And that was, you know, a heavily advertised play-by-mail game where you basically... And diplomacy. This has been talked about by other people, D&D historians, how a lot of early communications was with these diplozines, diplomacy zines. And a lot of they would, you know, diplomacy showed up in the mid-70s from Avalon Hill, and it was a very straightforward game in which you would event, you know, you're one of the countries of Europe and you're going to eventually, you have limited resources, and so you needed allies, but you would eventually have to stab those allies in the back, and it was all a question of when you were going to do it and who you were going to wipe out first. And it was about a 7-player game. It was very non-standard, but it did a lot for people designing their own version, you know, a Lord of the Rings, where they took the map and they divvied it up and everything, and a Conan version. And this, a lot of, you know, Gary's early writings came at where, you know, they're tracking it back and they're finding his articles and his reports from the early diplomacy scene.
Well, and I think what's kind of interesting is, so there's 10 years between us. So you started, you know, a decade before I did. So I came in strong in the 80s,
right?
Which would have been when Dragon Magazine was already established. But
and you probably played my stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah.
But early on the 70s, there wasn't that. All you had were these rules.
Yes.
And in these rules are not comprehensive. And
when I started, it was the little brown box, the little wood grain box,
yeah,
Greyhawk. You know, I remember when the Blackmore supplement showed up, it was the new hotness.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, and if you could get a hold of it, you could find the Strategic Review, TSR, which was the house organ for it was, and hardly an appendix in the fact that it was just, you know, like 8 pages. You know, and this is the first time they had someone design the Ranger class, that sort of thing. And then a friend brought to one of our gaming sessions the first issue of Dragon, which, you know, was, you know, okay, holy of holies now, and just, you know, old stuff. So you can see us evolve. You can see how the industry just sort of like got its feet and moved forward.
Yeah, it is interesting because, you know, the early material provided more like an engine, but not really the narrative structure or the world. Because I think the early expectation was for people to build that. So, I mean, it really left people, you know, people have always had the opportunity to expand out, but there really wasn't any sort of like ingrained expectation. I think that amount.
And that's true. I mean, basically the expectation was you build a dungeon, you know, I was an engineering student. And I had, you know, 10 to the inch graph paper and a boring trig class. And I basically was, you know, basically drawing dungeons in the back of the class. And that's where my first dungeons came from, as far as that. They were just a collection of rooms and they would have random monsters in it and no real explanation because, you know, you went down and you died.
Yeah.
A lot, you know, because in those days, you know, you had the second level as a cleric in order to cast a cure light wounds, you know, and if, you know, so until you got to that second level and suddenly you had survivability, there was a lot of, you know, character number 43, you know, and it was just, you know, getting started. But Greyhawk and, you know, the D&D came out of miniatures. I mean, its predecessor was chainmail, which was about miniatures. So a lot of the terminology that was used in the, as far as the rule set was concerned, was miniatures terminology, which not everybody understood because a lot of it came from, this is the group that's sitting around and playing, you know, playing medieval miniatures. And so it's using their terminology of earlier miniature games in what became the first role-playing game. And then suddenly it comes out from there. People start telling larger stories around. And you're not, you know, your figures don't represent, you know, 10 hussars. They represent one hero and, you know, one character. And so everything sort of grew out of that. John Peterson does some wonderful books on the history of role-playing games, playing at the world, and one more recently of how the fandom basically influenced early role-playing. You know, the West Coast group and, you know, the Outlarum's excursions, and basically the various people who started pouring in and creating and extending out role-playing, what role-playing was.
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, the technology we'll say was quote-unquote discovered. And then, but it's like people didn't fully like know exactly what to do with it. It's kind of like, you know, like Chinese inventing gunpowder. It's like, you know, what are all the possibilities? We don't know yet. I mean, it's easy to look back and wonder, you know, or maybe even critique or criticize or whatever, but starting from the beginning, it's like, it was just, this is newly discovered technology and its application really, I think we're still not even fully have explored all the avenues this can go, but you know, especially back then.
But we have explored those. We have been exploring those avenues. You see it in the different ages of RPGs. You see it with Vampire and the LARPs. You know, you see it as we move into expansion technology, into Ultima and the early online role-playing games within the, and then the MMOs. And all of that has become, you know, these major, you know, industries, but have their origin in role-playing games. When I was at Purdue University, we would Sunday night, we would be allowed to, you know, go to the local, to the computer room, which was, you know, like one big room with a lot of machines that you basically feed cards and tape into, and be able to play on machines that would allow us to play two types of games, which were, one was the roguelike, which is its own genre in computer games right now, which is, you know, basically you have that little nine area, you know, nine rooms on a level, and you're going down trying to find the Amulet of Yendor, and that's one. And the other one was Star Trek game, where you had the Enterprise and you were figuring out how to fire your photon torpedoes using polar notation. So, you know, I mean, these were engineers who were coming up with this sort of thing that basically, and you can see it in basically them bringing their terminology and, you know, their experiences to the table as well.
Yeah, and I find it's even fascinating that even with role-playing games now being explored, I think people using this for like therapy, and for working with children for education. I mean, it's really kind of interesting from the, you know, the satanic panic to actually being embraced by educators.
Well, what we've also see is that a lot of, you know, people who played D&D in the 80s are now in a position to dictate and steer what you see in popular culture. So now you're finally seeing the D&D movie. Now you're seeing references to D&D in Stranger Things. We had the opportunity to you know, be a part of ET, and we passed. The TSR passed on as far as being able to. And then it came out and became a big hit. It says, "Yeah, we have there's a reference to D&D. We didn't show the game at all." You know, they came to TSR and TSR said, "No, we're not going to." So.
Really,
it's like ET launched Reese's Pieces because the M&M company said no, you know. So
yeah, it's kind of amazing how far things have come over time, and I'm sure you've seen all the various stages from your vantage point. I'm sure it's a little bit different as far as seeing what's the reaction behind the people behind the scenes. I mean, I could speak to being, you know, as a consumer, but I'm sure these volatile times, these changes were probably very cataclysmic to those that are in these companies.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, it's well, for the end of TSR, what was purchased, one of the things that, you know, it was a major change in the hobby in the collectible card game. And this was Magic the Gathering. It had a fantasy base. We basically, you know, we were the fantasy people. And here's this other company that basically has come up with a new style of game and a new way of interacting. And they're doing it with a with some of the same tools that we were using ourselves. And that was, you know, impressive as all heck. And also, you know, we took a major hit as a result.
Well, I think that's what's the irony, because I think that was the first major hit. And the second one was with the MMOs to eat lunch. And I think that's what people thought, that, you know what, we're pretty much done. But it's interesting, because I think for us, having grown up without that, this was new stuff. But for kids who have grown up with this, the pen and paper, the tactile, the social gathering was the new thing. And for them,
both have advantages.
Yeah.
And with live play events, with, you know, Critical Role in that group, is that, we always said the best way to learn how to play D&D is to sit down with somebody playing D&D. Just have someone explain it to you at the table. So all of these, you know, what is role-playing paragraphs I've had to write over the years is, you know, it's a challenge. To say, okay, well, it's kind of like storytelling, and it's kind of like theater, and it's kind of like improv. You know, they say, oh, I know what it is. They watch what's going on, the YouTube videos, and they basically, you know, go and do likewise. And I think that accounts for a lot of the expansion of that we've seen in the past 10 years, 10, 15 years in role-playing, is that basically it's much more accessible to people. They don't have, I mean, I, you know, discovered role playing at the Purdue War Gamers Club, you know, because I had played a lot of Avalon Hill and SBI war games, and I showed up one day, and that's, you know, that's what the exposure to role playing is. Yeah, that's not something that's going to happen to everybody.
Yeah, and I think definitely, you know, being able, you know, it is, you know, before you had to know somebody.
Yeah.
And then you also then had to be feel comfortable to ask or be part of that group, you know? So it's like, there's like barriers to entry to just in the past, even viewing a game, or now there is, you just go to YouTube.
I was very fortunate. I mean, I learned how to play D&D and I came back to Pittsburgh, and my future wife, Kate Novak, she and her friends had a starship. They were Star Trek fans and they wrote Star Trek fiction, and they, you know, and they created their own starship, which was the SS Quetzalcoatl. And so they basically had that sort of like group adventure mindset. So when I said, I've got a game here that, you know, is a role-playing game, some of them moved very easily from that type of, you know, environment to we're playing fantasy characters and later superhero characters. So this was one of the great things about, you know, there are predecessors. There are the roots, the foundation for what would become, you know, the role playing phenomenon.
Yeah, because I mean, it is that creative outlet and being able to be in a more active way. I think probably the creating is very active, what was doing before, but this kind of, I guess, this interaction between people kind of adds. I think you can write all you want, but you're actually kind of determining the outcome. But when you're actually able to put into a game, you have the ability to be surprised.
It is participatory in nature. And so it's more of a group thing as opposed to an individual thing. I think that, you know, we see pulling pieces from the SDA, pulling people from the thing from fandom. We had the war gamers that basically laid foundation work. So suddenly you're seeing a lot of different foundational stuff in different groups that basically all have contributed to what became Dungeons and Dragons. And that's one of the interesting things, is everybody complains of one of the favorite gripes is, you know, they aren't playing the games my way. They've changed. It used to be cool. And it's never been that way. We've always had different flavors of fantasy. We've always had different ways of playing the game that has, you know, taken over the one of the reasons given for AD&D was, we had West Coast operations like Arduin, Chaosium, that were really, pulling out the stops and getting very wild and getting very, very, over the top. And the feeling was, no, we've got to stabilize. We've got to basically get a rule set. These are the rules. We have to organize ourselves. None of this, we don't say percent liar, or, your hero, you have a hero that basically acts as a champion plus one, no, we're going to organize that stuff. And that's an area that I don't think we've dug into enough. It's before my time. It's my golden age when I was playing, as opposed to, I always say I'm a man who was swallowed by my hobbies. So basically from, like 82, 83 on, I became, part of the problem in the fact that I was on the inside now, writing and creating and storytelling, and we were, seeing what could be done with this engine that we created, and what are the pluses, what are the minuses?
Yeah, it's also interesting to me, like some of the things that has like been removed that I thought was so great, like for BX. The reaction table.
Yes.
Absolutely beautiful technology. Like it works so well. And it was stripped out of later versions, which I don't understand.
The reaction table, are you talking about the which one are you talking
about? It's a 2d6 when you encounter a creature or somebody for the first time, you roll to see it there.
Friendly. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like that's
elegant. Mm-hmm. And it works if you're playing off the spur of the moment,
removed. And I find it kind of weird that this was probably when I think a huge step of innovation.
Yeah.
And I wonder why it was stripped out in later editions.
I can't tell you, but you know what? It'll come back,
Oh yeah.
Because I see that. I mean, basically, we see a lot more storytelling as far as here's our story, so we're going to know this character, and this character is going to have reactions like this, etc. And what the reaction table harkens back sort of to the hex crawl type of thinking, where you were making up as we go along, random roll tables, random monster tables, used to be the upper levels of a dungeon were safer than the wilderness. Because the wilderness, I could go out there and run into a green dragon on the second day. It was the first level. I got kobolds, I got goblins, I might have an ogre, So it was the way it was set up was basically it was safer in the early levels of the dungeon as opposed to, going in deeper. And as I said, my first dungeon was random roll. It was basically, I had my charts and everything, and I was coming up with this stuff.
Yeah, and I think there's definitely, especially starting out, there's a certain amount of excitement of just of just learning the rules and learning how things work, and combat's fun.
Yeah, yeah.
And I still think it's, most people don't want to do that all the time, but there's a certain amount of joy of just rolling some stuff up and having a combat.
We have my Monday night game is run by Steve Winter, who was my editor for many years at. Our co-creator of the Marvel Superheroes game, and he's our GM, and we are running through a old school mega dungeon set in a canyon with a whole bunch of different creatures, levels, all over the place. Go into one cavern and fight kobolds. We'll go into another cavern and there's an army of orcs mounted on bats, that sort of thing. And okay. We can sometimes find out we're in over our head. And so level is just an insane thing as far as, that's concerned. But our gaming style very much is kick in the door, take out the bad guy. And we've slowly been evolving to the go kick open the door, threaten them until they give us what they want, and then go on. We don't want to kill you. We're looking for this particular magic item, this MacGuffin. So.
But let's just make it easy on both of us.
That's my Monday night crew. So,
yeah, that sounds like about fun.
Six, seven of us, five of us show up on an evening. We have four and we can play. We play online. And that's another component that makes modern role-playing games you know, more accessible is that people are playing online. We get on Zoom, we get on Discord, and we can, you know, interact without having to go anywhere. So, you know, during the pandemic, this was a, you know, a great way of, you know, keeping in touch and keeping groups together.
Yeah, it is pretty amazing. I think those very tools that we thought was pulling, you know, go back to the MMOs mm-hmm. and such. The yes. online stuff was what was killing, but now that's the actual probably one of the things that's actually vitalized role-playing games is the connectivity over the internet and being able to have a means of easily communicating back and forth.
And I think one thing that, you know, basically I think is appealing about, you know, tabletop as opposed to online MMOs is that, you know, we have to standardize things in online MMOs. So you deliver a solid experience and basically make sure there's, you know, not a lot of not unevenness, you know, unfairness, you know, whereas tabletop, you can, under the control of a GM, you can set the levels, and then as you go forward, realize, oh my God, these people are in over their head. You know, you might want to give them a bullet hole. You may want to let them find a cave to hide in. You know, that sort of thing, and that sort of, you know, narrative influence is and cooperative influence is not there within a computer control. Now, God knows with what they're doing with, you know, ChatGPT, we may get to that point. You know, where it's sort of like start comprehending and playing the odds that way.
You know, we talked beforehand, and I know you can't talk specifics, but I think working on an MMO in general, the process, I think it'd be interesting to discuss. So yes. you've been working. Yeah. So you've been working on MMOs for how long?
Oh goodness, about 20 years now. I left Wizards of the Coast, worked for a lot of small operations, and was actually hired freelance by a German part of Ubisoft to work on one of their Settlers projects. And from that, had the opportunity to, because I knew people there, join Guild Wars. That would be ArenaNet. And I blew my first interview. Because I didn't play enough MMOs, but I did get hired by them eventually, and, you know, basically started doing what I would do very well for traditional tabletop, build world, and help contribute to that. And when you're working on playing a computer game, they both pair off differently. But working on an MMO, my current job, I work as a senior writer for ZeniMax Online. On Elder Scrolls Online, which is their MMO version of Elder Scrolls. But it's a cooperative project. Everything you see on the screen is because someone sweat bullets to put it. Yeah. There's a bunny hopping in the background. Okay, somebody had to, you know, concept the bunny. Somebody had to basically create the skeleton for the bunny. Somebody had to animate the bunny so it looked like a bunny when it hops. Someone had to do the skin for the bunny and probably do several skins, because if you're going to do a bunny, you might as well do a snow hare, yeah, you know, and a jackrabbit, and, you know, something with tentacles, just because, you know, those are different zones you have. So basically you're using the same resources again and again, and then somebody else creates another piece that fits in, you know. Basically everything is there because a whole team of people came together to make it happen. They're very complex creatures nowadays, MMOs. And as a result, whereas we can play with what they call theater of the mind, where it's, I say, you see a castle in the distance, you know, and there's a dragon flying around. And I can hear the artists and the animators going, oh, no, we can't. You're basically putting a castle against a skybox that we can do, but then animating something on that skybox, that's a challenge. So there's limitations of the machinery itself, which is basically we're playing inside a very tight little universe. Plus, you know, plus the idea that every time we create an asset is we want to find other uses for it. Every time we create an event, we want to create other, you know, experiences for it. We don't want to just do something that's going to be done once and never going to see it again. No, you want to have scenes that are repeatable experiences that allow people to engage with it no matter when they join in the timeline. Whereas your D&D experience, you can have the game and you can kill Strahd, and Strahd is dead, and you've done the job. You've completed it, and your group feels fat. You don't have to worry about never having to go back, and that all those resources are done. You've had a great meal. You don't worry about the leftovers. So again, advantages for tabletop against MMOs.
So you talked about world building, going back to that. So. Mm-hmm. When you say world building, that you did world building, so are you talking about building like a world Bible? What was your
a lot of those?
Like your first role, what was, when you said world build for your first role, like, or early on, what did that really entail?
The first, that's a good thing, because back in those days, this was Tauril, which became the name for the Forgotten Realms planet. So they basically, this is something that I'm going to mention later on. We're stealing from our previous experiences. Okay.
Yeah.
My gods ended up going to Dragonland. The name of the planet went over to the Forgotten Realms. Stuff just works like that. And initially, it was because the experience of D&D was you going down to the dungeon, you kill monsters, you take the treasure, was the dungeon itself. And what I ended up creating was a mega dungeon with multiple entrances across the continent. So I had Dungeon Entrance A and Dungeon Entrance B and Dungeon Entrance C. And Dungeon Entrance A was set in the middle of a town that became known as, well, it became American Pie. And I named my cities after like songs and locations. B was Bellevue, C was Cooper's Rock, E was Emerson on Lake Palmer.
Emerson on Lake Palmer.
Cheesy as heck, and that was cool, But in the players, again, the players, when they come in, they start changing the world. They realize they can make long-distance travel just by going through these dungeons. So they started clearing out paths between the various entrances and discovering where it was and building their own internal network that allowed them to trade and get to places they needed to be. And that was a pretty impressive decision on what to do. So my first world ended up from dungeon to overworld, and the decisions I made in that dungeon affected the eventual overworld itself. And because I had cleric, I had to, what are the gods? Do I want the gods that, basically pick a pantheon, you're Norse, that doesn't work. Greek, not so much. We built our own pantheon. By that time, Monster, I think the Platinum Dragon was mentioned first, maybe Greyhawk, maybe in Monster Manual 1. But the idea that, the idea of a dragon god, we have a good dragon god, we have a evil dragon god. And you can look at the gods, which eventually went into Dragonlance, and you say Kiri Joleth was the fighter's god. And, Sargonus was the monk god. Basically they were laid out on a framework of these are my classes. Each class gets a god as a representative, so people could Mashaka the healer was much more clerical type god, which would evolve into the idea of the healing portfolio or the healing domain that they would later pick up and say, yes, this makes your cleric different. And because it started off with lawful neutral chaos. And then expanded out into good and evil. So I had, I had good, neutral, evil gods, and seven of each. And it sort of like evolved into what you see. We took those components, and we moved them over to Dragonlance when we were getting started. Because, I've got a couple of dragon gods in this mess. About dragons and dragons. And so Tracy basically adopted it and. Again, change things, Gilead the book became Gillian the book. Gilead the book was like, there is no bomb in Gilead. I took a lot of a book called Everybody in the Bible and used it as, a basis for my for my naming conventions for all these guys. So, you know, basically twisted names, and they twisted the names. Mashakal, I believe, changed genders, which is not, you know, not something that's unusual in the stuff I've done over the years. I know there's still a discussion whether Tiamat is Takisis or not. So, you know, that's an online fight. I have opinions. I may someday voice them, but
it may be on your last, be in your will that it,
in my will, it gets opened up. Open and, it says Takisis is not Tiamat. Ha! Right now they are, you know, within the canon, you know, and canons change over time.
Well, you don't really, I mean, canon is whatever the company at this moment in time states for their official rules. This,
yep.
But you know what? We're free to do whatever we want.
Yes, you are. You basically have your own, you know, own, and you see that in various, you know, campaigns, in OGL campaigns, and people who say, I'm going to get back to BX. I'm going to get back to the little brown, little white books, the little brown books.
Yeah.
You know, basically. And, you know, I see looking at some of them, I look at them and some are very good. And, but I'm also looking at places where they've taken this out. We're going to be true to the original BX. And here's a component that we're rooted from fourth. Okay. Yeah. So people always have built their own house rules. And built their own, you know, universes. And that's kind of cool, you know?
Well, I think we had to back in the, I mean, as teenagers with Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, it was kind of a hot mess.
And time on our hands. So, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So we were doing all sorts of crazy things.
And again, you know, Greyhawk started as miniatures, you know, combat miniatures. Dragonlance, you know, started as the concept for a story. Telling within that universe, within a universe, the realms was originally the realms predates the Forgotten Realms, the TSR version, in that they were a setting for Ed Greenwood's stories that he wrote at a very young age. His first one was One Comes Unheralded to Xerta, which you probably can find online. The realms very much became a place where we could put as many orphan projects that were just hanging out there. Somebody did an adventure, you know, and basically, yeah, here's a place for that. Yeah, here's a place for that. Here, we're doing books. Here's where we can put this book. I mean, the first year of Forgotten Realms, I had a map that Ed Greenwood had made a copy of his home map, sent to me. I assembled it and drew things on it and made changes. And it hung outside my office, and I had areas laid out. He goes, and this is where we're putting the Age series, and this is where Doug Miles is playing with the Moonshade. And here's the, you know, Doug, like, if you're going to go hang out in Cormyr or the Daylands, let's talk to Ed, because that's where one of his home campaigns is based. So basically, I knew where everybody was. I was a traffic cop for the Forgotten. And that map now is hanging in the, I guess, the ceiling of the Game Hole in Madison. Game Hole Con is coming up as we take this. They basically, you know, got a hold of it and very happy to, you know, to have it. They asked ask the origins for it.
Hmm? So what was your reaction? I mean, I you knew the map was coming and it came in individual sheets of paper, right?
Yes,
it did. Tape together. So what was, I mean, like when you actually got them, like the post comes.
Yeah.
And like I want to know what was your thought at that moment? Like,
oh God. Well, okay. First off, I'll tell you the whole story, and I've told the story elsewhere as well. So okay. I'll be as succinct as I can humanly be. Dragonlance had come out and it was doing very nicely. But they were considered, it was a worry that was a flash in the pan. What do we do next? You know, it was basically, okay, we did real well with this. Can we do it again with something else? And we threw around ideas, and I was the bright soul who said, well, you know, Ed Greenwood has done a whole bunch of these articles for Dragon Magazine, and they're set in the place called the Forgotten Realm. You know, Elminster shows up in Ed Greenwood's kitchen, drinks his beer, and tells you about Seven Swords of Cormyr. And I said, well, let's check to see if he has anything more, if he has a real world under it. He's just making it up as he goes along. And I called up Ed, and I asked him, you know, would you be interested in selling your world? And Ed's response was, well, you've already published some of my stuff, so I already thought, think you own it. And I paused for a moment and I said, Ed, I'm not going to tell anybody you said that because we'd like to pay you real money to be able to use your world. And he started, and we made a deal. And he started sending me his notes from his campaign, his maps. We were talking with somebody just the other day about the Waterdeep Bay map. City system became city system, which was even with the original the Forgotten Realms maps. He literally brought his campaign map, which was like mounted on Bristol board, and you know basically he worked at a library and he would basically move it around on the photocopier to make sure everything you know got photocopied properly. And I got like 24 sheets of paper and taped them together and made them you know turn them into the first draft of the map that we had. And I don't know, I think it was like 60-some pages of paper for Waterdeep itself. Because he, and we ended up hanging it in a stairwell, just because we couldn't find any other space for it. Yeah. We had a two-story stairwell overlooking a feature we called the time tunnel. And basically, that's where we hung it. And that's why we had city system, is Ed had this huge map. But getting stuff from Ed was an experience in that he would send it from Canada. And early on, we would have, you know, stuff would not appear. You know, we'd get lost in transit. So we got him a Federal Express account. So he would start FedExing material, which helped our time on it and helped our, you know, basically making sure it got insured and it was here. But I would get a package and I would open it and it would be wrapped inside the package in brown paper. Okay, I'd take out the brown paper and then it'd be under this heavy Canadian saran wrap, which, you know, you could insulate windows with. This big, thick plastic. Okay, we take that off. Then it's got foil around it. Okay, I'll take that off. Then there's another layer of paper, of brown paper, and that comes off. And then he has the disc that came with it, the little 3.5, you know, floppy. And that's wrapped in plastic and paper. And so everyone in my corner of the office knew when I got another package from Ed, because there would be this 5 minutes of tearing, shredding, and cursing as I keep, and occasionally the phrase, "Oh my God, there's another layer." And he sent me, and literally he would cut and paste material, literally, in the fact that when he was doing his notes for stuff, you know, if he single spaced everything, very thin margins. You know, and if he had a thought that was on another page, he would take it and he would tape that and sideways along the side with an arrow pointing to it. And at one point, his typewriter, his T broke. So he was handing out, he was basically drawing in that he would finish a page and would draw in the little T's by hand. So it was like working in a tiny graveyard, you know? And I had one situation where, because Ed loved to digress, you know, in his personal notes, because as he would come up with ideas, he would just keep writing. And so you know, at the bottom of one page, he would begin a sentence, and then it would be a paragraph and an M dash, a square bracket, and close that square bracket, but open up another square bracket, then two more parentheses, then another parenthesis, and it would go on for the next page, single page, and then end on the third page with a single word. So it was really, you know, the early material, but a lot of that stuff, if you go back to the gray box set, you'll see that stuff that there's often, we talk about an area and then we say Elminster's note. Those Elminster notes are very close to what Ed originally had to say about those areas and his notes. We basically, you know, transcribe them and clean them up. And so we have, for example, a huge section about the Witches of Rashomon. And we don't have anything at all about Sembia. Because Sembia was, in Ed's campaign, the place where, you know, greedy merchants came from that allowed the players to basically con them and rob them. So they all came from Sembia. No one ever went to Sembia. They didn't have to do any work on Sembia. So there was nothing on Sembia. So at the time we said, you know, well, we were just going to leave Sembia to you. We aren't going to go in and talk about it, because we didn't have it. And eventually we did go in, you know, because things get filled in.
Well, I think going back to the, you know, the work that you got from directly from Ed, and you talked mm-hmm. about how he kind of went into these subroutines and digressions and retrogression. Yes. It you know, right now we have the benefit of word processors and computers, and we can mm-hmm. edit. But what you're actually seeing is like stream of consciousness writing unedited on yes. how a person's, you know, especially Ed's brain is working. And it's mm-hmm. interesting to me to see how, you know, people kind of think everything's done linearly, but it's kind of interesting to see a person's actual like thinking process.
Thought process as yeah. it goes along. And he would cut up pages and he would reassemble them.
Yes.
You know, and basically photocopy the reassembly. Because he worked in a library. He had free access to a photocopier. Part of the deal that we made with him to buy the Forgotten Realms involved a computer. We sent him a computer.
made sure that the keyboard had a T on it too, right?
Well, but we didn't send him any memory. So he's swapping. It's one of these, you know, Macintosh SEs that had two slots. So he's yeah. always swapping disks out so he can basically load the Word program and then he can, you know. And so after the first year, we sent him memory after the first year because just to make his life easier, because and the fact that things were going very, very well for us.
It's kind of interesting, you know, it's kind of hard to, with the ubiquity of computer technology and its low cost, the fact that, you know, that was a capital investment in a freelance writer.
I mean, we were talking about technology, but this was at the dawn of desktop publishing.
Yeah.
This was at the dawn of personal computers, where they became truly ubiquitous. This was at the dawn of Federal Express, where suddenly you could be, this was, you know, we didn't have the internet yet. We didn't have that ability. We had, oh gosh, at one point, I think we had an internet line that went to one station. You know, that was basically our line to the outside world as far as that was. As far as being able to access computer AOL right. online.
Those heady days.
Those halcyon days.
Halcyon days.
Mm-hmm. But that was, you know, technology that then helped boost what we were doing.
Right.
It was no longer as necessary for us to be, you to be present. It was no longer as necessary for, now, we had one project we did for Marvel late in the 60s were the handbooks, the phone books, as we call them, of the Marvel Universe. Marvel did an official handbook of the Marvel Universe, which was very helpful for us when we did Marvel because it told us, you know, where they thought the abilities were of the various
characters. You're talking about the comics, or are you talking about an actual book?
We're talking about the comic. Well, they were comic books
originally. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
They were comic books. There was the official handbook, and then there was the deluxe handbook. And then
yeah, I had those.
They've done hardbacks and all sorts of stuff since then. But they had this stuff, and it was available. And that became source material. And one of our management said, hey, we can do this. We can basically get them. They send us the discs with their text on it. We add our gaming material and we publish it. Easy peasy. And then we discovered they didn't have computer files for all of this text describing everything about Captain America and his history and his shield and everything. No, that was set. And basically they didn't have that data. So we ended up scanning it with an early optical character reader.
Really?
And then having to go through and re-edit it.
I don't know that saved you any time.
Well, it's even better. When we were done, we sent the computer files back to Marvel so they would have them. So then that was, you know, that evolution of the entire, but you know, those, you know, the big thick handbooks was, oh my gosh, people love those. Those were really, you know, good because we took, you know, like they handled like 64 pages and we had these, you know, 300 page volumes that basically about four or five of them that basically people can, you know, basically look up their favorite character.
Yeah, no, I deeply enjoyed it. It besides just necessarily comparing power levels, but just the history and yeah, I mean, I guess it allowed. It's kind of interesting. I mean, I guess thinking back kind of allows a person to explore the characters in a different angle, more from a, like a, you know, research encyclopedic way rather than just mm-hmm. reading a story, which was satisfying.
I think it helped, you know, also, you know, deliver the world deliver the people love being experts, knowing everything about, who would win Thor versus the Hulk, and, basically having something that allowed them, to basically give them that Talmudic knowledge of it. And that was again, a phase of comic book as well. And, that was an era.
We're still in this. It's the same thing with any sort of IP that people dearly love, with Star Wars and all of a sudden changing canon, people lose their minds because they had all that intellectual investment. Now you just made it worthless.
they've done it a couple of times. When they did the prequels, they changed the history of the stormtroopers, and suddenly, oh my God, all this stuff that has been written is no longer valid. In comics, they've ended the world and restarted it so many times. It's a little bit muddy right now about knowing what the past truly is, So, this is part of the process of creativity. I mean, as people come in, things will change. Things will hand off, and I'm very happy with the fact things have continued to grow and evolve. The realms, they're taking it in different directions. They're having different focuses, and that's cool because that's part parcel of what we're doing. I'm good with it. People keep saying, "Oh yeah, we like the old stuff."
Well, it's like I've heard. I know this is true, but back in like the '90s or maybe '80s, people made some comment to Stephen King about really how terrible the movies were. Mm-hmm. And I think his basic response is like, you can still read the books.
And different medium and different markets, put different demands.
Yeah, but if you don't like what they're doing, I don't understand why people get so upset when things get changed, because there's still all that material from the past.
Yeah, but no, because nobody's generating new material for your thing. Basically, you've got an era and it belongs to long, and you're very attached to it. And they're going off and do another thing. So,
yeah, but I think that
I'm a comic book fan, and I just really want them to come back and do the Legion right. They keep doing the Legion of Superheroes in the future. They keep reinventing it. And I belong to the era where basically Sunboy is running a holographic D&D campaign. So that's sort of my era, and I read modern stuff, and fine, you guys go have fun, but it doesn't work anymore the same way.
Right, and that does become hard. I see what you're saying. I was thinking more of the D&D stuff, but for comic books, the idea, because with the role-playing stuff, people can still put stuff out, even if it's an unofficial capacity. Mm-hmm. But for comic books, that's a different story. So if you said, man, I really love the 60s style of Justice League, you're not really going to get that anymore.
No, and they do. They attempt it every so often. I mean, basically, they will do something basically harks back
to like Batman 66 or something like
that. Yeah, that's a good example. Lost it. Okay, I had a point, and I have no idea what it is.
Yeah, I think the thing is it is interesting about fandom, and it's interesting about I think the dilemma to me is if you have an intellectual property and it's been around for 80 years or however long, boy, it's hard. You want to also stay relevant, but also too, it's like you've already told a bunch of stories. It's like with Batman, it's like they're still trying to find new ways of doing Batman, but how do you keep from just or Superman, just the same old stories again?
Well, the thing that bothers me about Restart, every jumping on point is a jumping off point. We're going to, if you reintroduce the Legion again as being a brand new operation, they will now meet the Fearsome Five for the first time. They've met him for the first time about five or six times now. So, how are we going to make it different? How are we going to elevate the,
How many times does Uncle Ben have to die in front of our eyes? Exactly. How many times does Bruce Wayne's parents have to get shot in front of our eyes?
They're doing a series where he actually witnesses it yet again, and it's a nightmare. They're doing like a whole month of all the superheroes have nightmares at the time we're recording. That's the current thing. That's the current little boomlet they're doing. So for a couple weeks, they're basically telling stories. And I still read a lot of Marvel. don't read as much DC. Reading some independents, so, you know.
I broke away from comics for a while, but then I picked up a subscription to Marvel Unlimited.
Okay. Oh, yeah, online. Another
it's on my tablet.
Of technology changing how you're engaging with the IP. Yeah.
Yeah, so I find in general, just making a general statement, that modern comics, I think, do a better job of storytelling. But boy, there's a whole lot less content in it. It's a lot less words. Because before, I used to be packed with exposition. Now you can flip through a comic book. Well, Jack Kirby. Just pick a Jack Kirby comic book and a latest Daredevil comic book. And there's no comparison to the amount of words in there.
Yeah, I'll give it to you. Give you that. I think it comes and goes. Because, you know, when we started, one of the things that I read comics as a kid. And I dropped out when I got back and got to college. The guy in the dorm room next to me basically read comics. So I started reading comics again. And from there, the Star Wars comic was just coming out. Howard the Duck was just coming out. I would buy Star Wars comics and send them to Kate. You know, basically, so because she was a Star Wars fan as well.
That's true.
And, I'd mail it to her. Yes, yeah, true. But the idea is that at that time, a Spider-Man comic book was, When Comes the Kangaroo, or Terror is the Grizzly, and that was sort of like, and now they seem to have moved a lot beyond that. And they're dealing with a lot of more political situations. They're dealing with a lot more emotional situations. There's a lot more than just. So I think, again, if I was to do Marvel superheroes again, I would take a serious look at what our goals and karma systems were to basically make it fit with the type of stories that they're telling nowadays.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I agree. Mm-hmm. I think what I think is also different is Kirby's stuff comes more feeling like it came off the where books were premier and there was a lot of exposition to get things mm-hmm. going, where it seemed like the more modern comics take their cue more from cinema.
Right. And I agree with you. I think that basically using that, the strengths of story of comic book storytelling, panels and gutters and everything, to basically move the plot forward. Some of my favorite panels back from that era when I started was single panel that shows the Beast swinging through, 14 different, flagpoles, basically and in a single panel to show that he's extremely dexterous and fast, and that sort of thing's cool as well. So I think that had a lot to do with it as well.
But I think there's also, it seemed like to me, a lot of those earlier ones tried to create a complex, like it seemed like, especially with Kirby stuff, mm-hmm. not that I'm really on Kirby, because I absolutely love Kirby, his work, but it's like, he had a complex world and he felt the need to get you up to speed, by page one of mm-hmm. a very complex, like the Eternals. Like, we're going to just throw in all this information through dialogue. Like, it's like.
And during the Jim Shooter years, a rule they had is you should put an action sequence in early where everybody on the team gets a chance to use their powers. So basically, every comic book could be someone's first comic book. They basically need to basically make sure it's again, going back to a very discussion. It is the, what is an RPG paragraph? Who are these X-Men? Because they were just getting, restarted when I was getting back into comics.
But you stay in the Jim Shooter principle. Now that makes me think that's kind of interesting. Way of thinking about is as maybe even adventure design.
Yeah. I think that's also applicable. It's the idea there are ones where you can basically, there's an expectation of what you're doing,
Everybody gets to demonstrate an ability. Like maybe you need to write scenes to make sure, maybe one big scene where you offer a number of different options for different characters to do different things.
And that challenge there, of course, is character class. It's basically, and the more character classes you have, the more you have to, basically spread that out. So, and that's, again, one of the challenges. But basically showing them how it interacts. Another component that you still see to this day is the example of play. Of basically people are sitting around, they're talking about what their character sees and who they are. And it's very telling as far as when people were saying, my character does this in one example, and I do this in another. So basically, you've seen different levels of identification, how the GM functions, when he's calling for roles, etc. And this, so you can look at the how to the character example to get an idea of what they're trying to simulate, of what they believe their strengths are.
Right.
I mean, we talk about new modern things. One thing I find interesting and challenging is the play style of games like Blades in the Dark.
Yes.
And yes. And Blazing Wheel. And these, they've shown up in the last 20 years. They've become much more popular in the last 10. And this is the idea where the GM doesn't do all the prep work. He doesn't design the dungeon. He doesn't design the world. He basically helps discover the world with the players. And in this place, you know, he's still acting as a referee, but he is not, you know, basically in control of the situation. So the players help build it. And that puts a lot more responsibility on the players as well to drive the plot forward. What are my needs? What do I want? As opposed to the GM, again, using, it wasn't Dashiell Hammett, but basically one of the detective writers think, when things bog down, send in two goons with guns. Oh. You know, basically, yeah.
Yeah. Was it Philip Marlowe?
It was a Marlowe writer, and which is terrible because I've devoured all his books and I cannot, and now someone's going to put into the comments, oh yes, it was, you know.
Yeah, but I think also what's interesting about Blades in the Dark is they've also created mechanics to have to reduce the amount of planning people do. You just have to give a basic plan. And so they're able to cut out the unnecessary, but the tedious stuff and get right to the action.
They get right to the action, and they also basically live off the sense of retcon. There was a 90s game, I think, called Baron Munchausen, which was the idea of, you know, someone makes a statement, you challenge, and then you say, oh, no, but you forget, you ignore it. What you're not paying attention to is the fact I was wearing my boots of leaping at the time. Yeah. Oh, well, I thought boots of leaping only worked once per week. That's true. But this was my spare pair of boots of leaping. So, you know, and that's sort of, you know, the storytelling. It basically evolves in many ways into the Blades of the Dark type situation, and it's been incredibly popular. There's been a wide variety of them. What's the other engine powered by
Apocalypse
engine? Yeah. The Apocalypse engine was also the Chandler.
The what? Chandler. Yes, Chandler.
Mm-hmm, was the writer? Sorry, no, I knew it was okay. Going to pop up at the worst possible moment. The And what were we talking about before?
So basically, we're talking about cutting to the chase and getting to the interesting parts, to the action rather than cutting out the boring spots.
And the retcon concept they have within Blades, I played it a couple of times. I haven't DM'd it because, to be honest, I'm a little bit intimidated by it. But it's the idea that you can basically come up with a spur of the moment idea, go back in narrative time, basically set up the fact that you got the key from the guard. You know, and there are some price to pay for that, but then you can basically move the plot forward. Trail of Cthulhu is very much about, you know, making sure that you get the clue. In the traditional Call of Cthulhu, give me a spot hidden roll. You blew it. Exactly. Okay, the plot stops now until I figure out how to get you moving forward again. The Trail of Cthulhu rules basically aim specifically at that weakness. And basically says, if you're at this level, you find it anyway. It's just a question of how, of, you know, what type of complications are going to show up as a result.
Like, one of my favorite games was Champions. Love Champions. Yeah. But for really Champions to really sing, I think you really, the GM needed to put lots of fun set pieces in there and objects, which is very difficult.
We've done that with, we did that with Marvel as well. We did that with, you know, basic, a lot of rooftops that had, you know, things you could throw at each other.
Right. But I think the thing is that as if you're creating an adventure, trying to think of all the crazy little things and put them in there.
Yeah.
But if you have a game system where, you know, if the player could just say, hey, I pull up a manhole cover and throw it, you don't say, well, there's no manhole cover on the map. That, I mean, or you think, oh, as a GM, I should put a manhole cover.
You basically say, you want to say yes. And when we did Marvel, I would get three types of comments. I love your game. I love your game, and here's how you fix it. And I play champions. And I play champions, and I buy everything you've made in order to transfer it over to my system. Because, you know, champions is, you know, has an ornate, you know, min-maxer's paradise for its skill generation. So the character generation is a very important and involved part of the game itself. And the combat, you might get through two or three rounds before, you know, before night falls.
Yeah.
And it's just, and there were two big, you know, it was the East Coast, West Coast thing, superhero games. There was Champions, which had a very strong basis out of the West Coast. And there was Villains Vigilante, which basically operated more out of the East Coast. That was more of a, you know, lightweight. And Marvel sort of came in looking at both of them and sort of was in between the two, in two levels in complexity.
Yeah, I've never played Marvel. I've never played any Face Rip, and that's something I really want to rectify in the next few years.
I don't know how I bought the preliminary version of the new Marvel superhero game, in which the ability scores spell out Marvel as opposed to Phase Rip, which I thought was just sort of like a really cute thing. But I thought it was, you know, an excellent start. And I'm really looking forward to seeing the final product. Because, you know, I do still buy, I do read, I still play. I try to play new RP. A couple months ago, we were playing Lex Arcana with my Saturday night group, which is mostly a Call of Cthulhu bunch, but we're trying to move into different, I'm trying to move into different, you know, try different types of game and basically trying because of such a wide variety and seeing what's there. And Lex Arcana is you are a member of the Caesar's X-Files in the fact that you're basically a legion that is set up to investigate creepy stuff and visions. And that's your job. And you travel all over the Roman Empire and, you know, the gods are around and you have, you know, various people, various gods, you know, favor you and you're dealing with, you know, rising pantheons and all sorts of things. But it's a kind of a cool little, the system was very nice. It worked out very nice. We ran that for a couple of nights. And Steve Winter, who's one of my regular moderators, has just, you know, so asked if we wanted to play this. And I've said, yes, this is called Gray Seas Are Dreaming of My Death. And it is a William Hope Hodgson RPG. And I know you're saying, who is William Hope Hodgson? And he is one of the writers of before Lovecraft, around Lovecraft. And he wrote a lot of sea stories. And he's, you know, basically, he's definitely a slow burn. Your ship is becalmed in the Sargasso Sea. And wet footprints start appearing on the deck. And, you know, ball lightning, Elmo's fire is, you know, dancing among the tops of the masts. And it's basically a seaborne horror story. And, you know, he and I both had gotten it on Kickstarter. And he basically, you know, looked at it and goes, yeah, this would be interesting to try. So trying new games is part of, you know, what I'm up to as well.
Yeah, because I think it allows different experiences, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
It's kind of like, I think it's like music. There's some people that love a group of a type of music that they grew up with, and they are happy with listening to that same set of songs for the rest of their lives. There's other people who just say, okay, I still like those, but I want to hear some other things.
Yeah, I'm good with that. I definitely, you know, soured on the singer-songwriter, storyteller, you know,
yes.
mode. I was a big fan of it for a while, and now not so much. Okay, yes, I understand. You're depressed. You're in your taxi. That's good. Okay.
Yes. Almost Benny Goodman right now.
I love Jim Croce, but, you know, it just, ooh, there's a postmodern jukebox
you know. And I think you can go back, you know, bring up postmodern jukebox. It's kind of like, kind of what we're seeing at this age, right?
Yes. Postmodern jukebox is to music what OSR is to gaming, you know? Yeah. And they really, you know, they're taking modern songs and they're throwing them with a 1930s, 1940s swing era type of vibe. And they're just like, you know, retelling the story in a different fashion.
Yeah, there's another group called called Scary Pockets, and they do funk.
Okay.
And so there are also people who I've been also lately been listening to cello and piano covers of songs.
Yes.
And that's just like very good.
And I think this is actually something I've been, one of my problems with listening to music is singing along when I'm supposed to be working. There's a lo-fi type of, you know, YouTube is basically the video is just a anime of a girl, you know, studying, you know, at her desk. And the music is just very, very good. And it's low key. It evokes a lot of that Windham Hill sort of vibe that we had back from the 90s.
Yeah.
So I'd recommend that as well. So
I'd check that out. I also don't like, depends what I'm doing, but a lot of times I don't like words. So even like, if you want something upbeat, sometimes like there's Pamplemousse.
Pamplemousse, yes.
They did
a lot of covers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but they also did French songs. And now there's French songs.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it's like, that is very nice to listen to.
Advantage of being Canadian.
So the Pamplemousse are also the same people that is Scary Pockets. The keyboardist husband.
Yeah, does is Scary Pockets.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Because again, I've heard a lot of their, you know, a lot of their covers. And then some get from there, you get to their original music.
Yeah.
I think that's very good as well.
But the French works out good. I've listened to female mariachi bands. I mean, if you want to just talk about it.
Okay. I love the flavors that are available. I love the variety that's available. And that applies back to gaming as well. So, and we've got like, and even now, I think it is easier to create and produce a role-playing game and sell it than it was, you know, 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah, so right now I sell RPG supplements.
I saw your site.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So this would not be possible without Kickstarter.
Exactly. Exactly. That it allows you to target an audience. I mean, it is amazing. And yes, I do, you know, do a lot of Kickstarter's got some challenges to it. I'll be honest with you. Right now, shipping is killing everybody. And, you know, I would prefer to work with getting things out of England. And I prefer to, if they say, we've got it written, we need the money to basically print it. And that says, okay, that means you're that much closer. You've already, you know, got everything in hand. I've contributed to a lot of Kickstarters where, yes, we're going to work on it. And okay, that's a little bit more of a risk because a lot of stuff can happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, this is ironic. This is the irony because I will generally have a proof copy in hand at the time of the Kickstarter. That is my goal, to have a proof copy in hand at the time of the Kickstarter. And I also have paid everybody up to that point.
Right.
I also do not do stretch goals.
That's viable.
But the spirit of the Kickstarter would be like, I would have it open. And if I fund more, I would increase the size of the book. I would add artwork. Mm-hmm. I would do these things. But I won't do those because people are less confident. It was one reason. They're going to be less confident in it. So it's kind of this weird thing that the very thing that Kickstarter is supposed to be is fund these people's ideas and concepts, but in the end, it turns into being a fulfillment.
It can be a trap. I mean, basically, you know, Chaosium before its current administration got themselves into all sorts of trouble because they stretch goaled themselves to the point of non-profitability. Yeah. The idea of being able to, I can get better art. I can get art theory. I can basically, you know, pay a little more, get a little more pay. I can basically go with a different type of cover. Components of the product itself, I think, work out real well. And I think that's a viable set of stretch goals. Even if they're internalized stretch goals in which you basically think, okay, I can do this, but I'm not going to tell you.
Right.
You know, and I did a Savage Worlds Kickstarter.
Oh, you did?
Where it just sort of kept expanding beyond belief. And I got this huge box. And Steve Winter is a Savage World player. He's played and run a lot of campaigns. He pulls out the rulebook and he says, "This is what you need." And actually, only the first 20 pages is what you need. All the rest of this, with the templates and the tokens and the additional decks and everything, they're nice. But you know, those are just more tchotchkes. So I've had that problem of doing Kickstarters where they offer tchotchkes, and the tchotchkes just sort of like go all over the house after a while. So I find something. I'm like, what did that belong? That belonged to something that I bought, you know?
I've been fine even with PDFs. I the Modiphius 2D20, and also I got all these, it kept sending me PDFs. I'm like, I got more than that.
I have a problem. I do, you know, often get PDFs because, hey, you send it to the printer, you might as well send a PDF version to your backers. Yeah. That gives it to them right now, damn it. But I don't read on on my tablet. That's just it. I have put things on my tablet intending I'm going to go through them, and it's much more, it's too distracting. My tablet is too distracting. I've got my email there. I've got, you know, access to the net there. I've got games I'm playing online, and it's very tough. Whereas a physical book product focuses my attention and keeps it going. Not to say don't send me PDFs, but I have a lot of PDFs I have not gone through. You know, I'm waiting excitedly for certain games of which I already have the rules.
But what I found is I was big into PDFs up until maybe about 5 or 10 years ago. And I don't know if it's an age thing, but I'm more to the point where I'm wanting books more than the PDFs. I want the PDFs for reference and for searching.
Yeah.
But I want a physical copy for a lot of things for the actual reading through and reason.
Some of my gang for my, you know, Saturday night group, they, you know, basically have the rules and their character sheets on their iPad. And that, you know, that works out real well. And they're very dexterous with finding what they want and tracking it down. I've got the whole thing of, okay, I remember this rule. It was on the left-hand side of the page and there was a picture of a flower there. Okay. You know, and that's the sort of, you know, I know it sounds like I'm going back to a card catalog, you know, for which younger people need to look up what a card catalog is in order to find the book.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. That goes back to even for, like, it's kind of interesting about layout, where if you create some variation, variety, and what purpose art serves, it does tend to help people to kind of visualize.
It breaks up the page. It allows you to basically, get different forms, different formats. And also gives your eyes a little bit of a rest.
So. Yeah. So have you been involved lately, like in the last few years, with any pen and paper RPG products?
I have. I've done some essays for Kobold Publishing for their Kobold Guide.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I think I've read some of those of yours. Yes.
And those have been, you know, been very, very rewarding. And I'm currently a stretch goal on the Tenaris project RPG. They had a board game, they're doing an RPG, and I'm just doing a short bit for them because they said, if we get over, again, I'm the stretch goal. This is one way of doing it. If we get to this level, we'll get something from Ed Greenwood. We'll get something from Jeff Grubb. And they basically come and say, we'll be glad to, you know, basically bring you on. Will you be a stretch goal? So I'm a very minor stretch goal for that. But I don't take on, and I have been a design consultant for a recent product called Everyday Heroes, which is a 5th edition updating in the spirit of D20 Modern.
Yes, I've heard of that.
I worked on with Charles Ryan, Rich Redmond, and Bill Slavisek back 20 years ago. You know, it's just, oh my God. And that was, that has come out now. And the designers, and basically I worked as a design consultant, which means I read some of the manuscripts and said, well, okay, here's your challenge here. But it was a minor contribution, it was a review. But it's come out and it's gotten very good response. People are very happy with this game. And it's a huge, I'll do the showing off here. It's a monster.
Oh yeah, it sure is.
It's just, and this particular is the evokes the old is the Kickstarter version in the fact that it evokes the old D20 modern cover. But it's some 460 pages of goodness. So
it's like a color. Is that color interior?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. That's got a, that was not cheap to produce.
No, but it, but basically color, it's easier to produce now than back in the day.
Oh yes. Yes.
So where if we got a second color, oh my God, that was fantastic. The original gray box Forgotten Realms was printed in brown ink. And when we gave that little background pattern, it was just, you know, tough. But two color was a challenge back in those days. Yep. Sig Trent and Chris Ramsley, along with Dave Scott. And those were the guys who put it together. So Dave always says nice things about me. But to be honest, these guys did the heavy lifting. And, you know, they did a real great Kickstarter. They're putting one together for fantasy, modern fantasy type version, which is sort of like to this volume, what Urban Arcana was to D20 Modern, another project I worked on. Okay. And they, I've been doing adventures based on old movies and not so old movies. They did Pacific Rim, Escape from New York, Ultimate Soldier. Oh, yeah,
what's exactly the name of the company? Was it? Did you say it was?
Evil Genius Game.
Yeah, it's Gen Con. Yeah, because I remember hearing the guy on a podcast, and then there's another time where I went to Upwork. I was looking for an artist to do a cover.
Yeah,
and then I saw a review of an artist I was kind of considering, and the guy from Evil Genius had made a statement about this guy about how it didn't work out. Oh my goodness. Nice guy, but the guy's from another country. It's like his communication skills weren't great. And, you know, and so it's like his bad review was, I thought it was just kind of ironic that it was for an Evil Genius.
Well, I've had more than a few cases of having the weird review. Yeah. The weird, so we ask for something in the art, and then when we get it, we're going, no, we missed a step somewhere in the communication.
Yeah, that's something I'm still learning with me communicating with artists.
Mm-hmm. I always joke, if you ask for an army, they'll give you three figures. If you ask for three figures, they'll give you two. You know, it's. I've been incredibly lucky in my career in that I've worked with some fantastic artists.
Well, yeah, I can't imagine. I mean, you're in a perfect position. You have world-class artists, I'll say world-class, but very high-level artists at your beck and call fulfill art orders.
We've had good artists. We've had good art directors as well. And, you know, both PSR, Wizards of the Coast, and, you know, most recently working with the MMOs. The guys who are doing our concept art as well as our in-game art are really top flight.
Yeah. So, what I really want is I would love just to have the concept art. I'd be happy with the black and white concept art for these MMOs.
that's true. I mean, I love our concept art. I think that we had one for a guy for Arena, Daniel Dose too, who was just absolutely brilliant. You know, and the only thing I always drive him crazy with is the fact that everything he drew was like 25 stories tall. And so we would take his stuff and then shrink it down to a level where we could put it in the game. But his artwork was just great. Another modern artist who does a lot of Keitai Kotaku. And he's just did a great job when I was working at Amazon as well. So this was good stuff.
Yeah, there's something satisfying with stating a thing, putting out an order, and then getting the art back and seeing it. Just there's a certain magic to that.
Yeah, and often it's the case where I discovered this working with comic book artists, where you ask for something and they do better.
Yeah.
You know, they come up and they create something even cooler than what you anticipated.
So I was doing a post-apocalyptic zine, and I sent an art order in the fellow's, he's a man from Spain, but he lives in Taiwan. And so I sent him some my descriptions, and I'm in the Midwest and like walking stick and dragonfly, you know, these things. I kind of was playing off of those terms. And it became apparent when I got the art back, he didn't have a frame of reference for those, but he drew these things, which I thought was very kind of interesting. Cause I made some assumptions, but the art he provided was very, it was very satisfying because it wasn't exactly what I was thinking of. And, you know, it was kind of weird how, you know, I make assumptions in communication that may be completely wrong, but it still works out in a way that is really pretty neat.
A great Magic the Gathering story was, you know, one of the early art pieces they ordered was a black card that was a lemur, which was a Roman devil, a low-level Roman devil. I mentioned them in Monster Tournament. You know, and they had this black card for a lemur. And the artist gave them a lemur, which was this black and white monkey.
Yeah.
Out of Madagascar, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's why that black card has a monkey on it, as opposed to what they originally intended. Because, you know, sometimes and often it was a case where you get the art and there's no time to redo it. There's no time to basically, you know, okay, we got to go to press. We told people we're going to ship here. The deadline demands it. So they went forward with that.
Yeah. And I think the assumption is, you know, there's that cultural understanding that's shared that you don't need to communicate, but boy,
I'm still trying to understand how the Ankh of Mishra became a windmill, but you know, that was another card where the art came in and it was okay. How are we going to handle this? And this has happened, you know, more than enough occasions, you know, for over the years. On various types of products, and this is one of the challenges, as you know, of creating. So,
well, I think for me, I mean, deadlines are fairly flexible. Things don't work out at this moment in my life; it doesn't make a big difference. But you know, you have a big company and you have deadlines. Yeah. It's a big deal.
Yeah. I mean, even with you Kickstarter, and you know, your consumers have paid up front and will be understanding if it, you know, shows up a month late or 2 months late. You also have, when you get to a real company status, you a large company status, you're basically also worried about your cash flow. How are we going to pay for it?
Yeah.
How are we going to, you know, get people paid and, you know, keep things moving forward? And feeding the beast is one of the challenges. And I think one of the things that, you know, created all sorts of havoc for TSR back in the day.
Well, I think too, it's like, you know, you may have certain key, like maybe you want to, like for RPGs, and one of the big things maybe is to have a product ready for Gen Con.
Yes. Oh, back in the day. I don't think that's the case anymore.
But there still could be key things. Like maybe you got a release schedule of every 2 months. And if you don't have much, you can't have two releases at the same month. Like, you know what I mean?
Okay.
It's like, there's a point where you may be locked into certain things that does not allow you flexibility, or maybe whatever it may be, you're trying to meet, or maybe you're saying, I need to have 5 product releases this year. Otherwise my revenue is going to take a hit.
Well, you mentioned that back at TSR every year for several years, Jim Ward, who was our boss, and myself, would go back into the corner office where we had another Macintosh. And I was the only person who knew how to run, you know, like PageMaker on a Mac. And we would lay out the grid for everything we wanted to do for the next year. And of course, everybody has gotten their list of favorite stuff, and we can't have them all showing up for Gen Con.
Right.
We have to stretch them out over a longer period to basically create a schedule where the big Forgotten Realms project doesn't walk on the big Dragonlance product. And so we we aren't doing 4 box sets in the same 2 month period. So we are there, you know, basically how we're scheduling it out was part of the challenge we had. And we had to often drop projects just because there was no room in the schedule to push things off. Yeah, this is, you know, again, one of the challenges of running a larger company.
Yeah, yeah. It becomes difficult, but it's, when you have that flexibility, sometimes you can go to the artist and get some changes, but
yeah,
but man, if the artist shows up with the art late, and it is what it is.
It is what it is, you know, because often your freelance artists have a certain amount of time they've put into the schedule. This is where I'm going to do and do. And then I've got, you know, the next project and the next project. So basically, it's not like you have an art department where you pull somebody off one piece and basically assign them to another. Something that we had at TSR, fantastic art department. A lot of people are using freelance now as a result. So the art director becomes all that much more important as far as, you know, determining how a project works.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I can imagine. It's also interesting, too. It's like, you know, thinking back, because I used to been listening to some music history podcasts. And what I come to realize is that, like, music changes very quickly. Like, within two or three years, the genres will start changing and dramatically. And I just started thinking about, too, with RPGs, it's a similar situation with how things are ran, the things that are hot, the business models. Mm-hmm. It is, you know, you're talking about having an art department.
I think it's a lot more lead time because we have to write so much tech.
But as far as like you had art department, then it's freelancers. I mean, it's like how products being released, how products are being made, mm-hmm. the way the business looks, like even like with TSR, huge amount of releases under Lorraine to then up until recently with Fifth Edition, it was like, we're just metering this out to like just a couple releases a year. And
more than just a couple, because I've been collecting a lot of Fifth Edition material, and it's been a pretty regular schedule.
No, I mean, early on, it was the first few years, it was, I think, only one or two books a year, wasn't it?
Oh, you mean, well, that was early TSR. You're not talking about current WotC or early
TSR? I remember Hasbro with Fifth mm-hmm. Edition, like the first year they just had, I think, whatever that first adventure was. Like first for a while,
and the first three books.
Yeah, besides the first three books, I'm just saying it's like the supplemental mm-hmm. books. They're only doing like one or two a year for a while,
and all hardback. Yeah. I mean, they've abandoned the softback formula, which was part and parcel of the TSR later years.
So now they're kind of switching and pushing more towards appears maybe a more digital model. So
they're moving strongly in a digital fashion. I don't know where they're going to end up with that, but that's one of the challenges.
But it started out with Gary saying nobody's going to buy adventures. It's interesting on how everything has been changing, and I don't know that it's necessarily that people are getting it more right. It's just that.
But adventures basically work very well for the DM, and not everyone is a DM. So therefore, you know, what they're looking for is creating product that basically players can utilize more.
Right.
And you see this comes out of fourth edition, is the plethora, and this is carried over into fifth, is the plethora of battle map. It is the idea of, you know, here we can give you a map right now that you can play on, you know, put the characters on. Here's the encounter, here's the map for it. And so it's lists that, you know, theater of the mind or drawing with, you know, the colored pens on an erasable map sheet. They've done a lot more of being able to say you to basically sell that idea. And another component we haven't talked about, virtual tabletop, which are, again, another technological component that moves everything forward. So I do believe that, you know, that whatever the next edition takes shape as, it will have a very strong virtual feel as well.
So my hope, my dream is that a lot of these complex rule games from the 80s becomes very easy and fast to play.
Such as?
Rolemaster.
Oh, gosh. Yes, Tablemaster.
Tablemaster, yes.
I will mock it, but I did like Rolemaster and Law and Arms Law.
Yeah, if you could just condense it where you just click and everything's calculated,
You're seeing that in virtual tabletop. We use Roll 20 for our Monday night game. And so, basically we're rolling online and someone needs to call up the spell and there it is. And, you know, it's getting there.
But I think what's shifted too is like things start out simple wargaming, early D&D and Travelers, mm-hmm. you know, fairly. To much more complex systems, mm-hmm. and then after the 2000s, then it switched to simplification of mechanics for rapid play because people are playing at the table. But now that more people are playing virtual tabletop, having more complex systems goes more into the background and becomes more viable.
You have to design for those systems. I think that's one, again, MMOs. Basically, one advantage of MMOs is I just have to learn my character and how to fight, and I'm ready to rock, you know? And so everything else that's happening, that the computer is working on, all the animations, the bunnies in the background, that sort of thing, that's taken care of. So it's a lot easier for me as an individual to engage, but it also carries its own weight.
So I hate 3.5, but I love Neverwinter Nights. I would almost rather not play at all than play 3.5. I sure love playing Neverwinter Nights.
Okay. I understand the different editions have strengths and weaknesses. You know, I have been a fan of old, and I played all of them. So
I will say for 3.5, it's me. There's a reason why I dislike it, but you know what? Millions of people love it, and I'm not going to say it's a bad system.
Yeah,
but it just
a system for you.
Not a system for me. Yeah, for a number of reasons, but. But I'll play Neverwinter Nights all day long. I mean, I love it. So it's like, it's just kind of funny how that is.
And I think it's, you know, how you're approaching the process, you know, how the level of complexity and how you're willing to deal with it. So I don't know.
I think we're about ready to pierce the time space continuum. This might be a good stop for me and a good time for dinner for you.
Okay. Yeah. We've been rambling for a little while. I didn't expect to talk about any of this, by the way. So it's just.
I never know exactly. Sometimes I might know with some guests, but generally I have no idea where it's going to go. So, but boy, it's been a wonderful ramble, Jeff.
Okay. Well, thank you for bringing me along here.
Yeah. And then we'll have to do some rambling some more at a future date.
Cool.
Okay. Well, you take care.
Take care, Jeff.